The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening. This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs. Will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday and a busy, busy day at that. We have got so much territory to cover. We've got two amazing guests today, both Jason Leopold of BuzzFeed News and Tom Hartman will be joining us today. And there's other ground to cover. So let's get started by with a few laughs first from Stephen Colbert.
Trump defended his immigration deal with Mexico. On Friday, he agreed not to impose tariffs because he said that Mexico had just agreed to work to prevent illegal immigration coming into the United States through Mexico. But over the weekend, we learned that Mexico agreed to take these border actions months before Trump announced the tariff deal. So Trump threatened them with tariffs unless they did the thing that they were already doing.
Okay.
I gotta say, I think he would be a terrible hostage taker.
Give me the money in small, unmarked bills, or the old lady gets it. And I know you already gave me the money. I just love scaring old ladies.
Kaboom!
Right? Yeah.
There is... Who's that?
Okay.
Are you okay? You okay?
Okay.
Here's the thing, though. Trump insisted that there were more new, great things in the deal, tweeting,
more importantly, some things, dot, dot, not mentioned in yesterday's press release, one in particular, were agreed upon, that will be announced at the appropriate time.
So today, Trump answered his doubters in a way that I think deserves that we just take a moment. Every so often, you have to take a moment, like I'm asking you to do right now, to appreciate what a bizarre person is leading our country. Just take a moment before we do this. Cleanse your palate with a thought of any other president doing anything like this.
Yeah.
That's the agreement that everybody says they don't have. So, no, because I'm going to let Mexico do the announcement at the right time. From Mexico, they want to go through, but here's the agreement. It's a very simple agreement. This is one page. This is one page of a very long and very good agreement.
Look.
What?
Look, if I don't have a secret agreement with Mexico, then how do I have this people's paper right here? How do I have a piece of paper that I will not read to you, okay? Okay, and here's Middle East peace right here.
Yeah.
It smells so fantastic. Like this. Is that, yes, peace right there. There you go. All right. Okay, we got the Mexico deal, we got Middle East peace, and hold on, the Colonel's secret recipe right here. Just seven herbs and spices.
Then Trump laid out a challenge to everyone who did not believe him.
I just give you my word.
We would prefer something of value.
Come on, trust.
I'm sorry, sir, do go on.
Inside here, and I would love to do it, but you will freeze action it, you will stop it, you will analyze it, every single letter you'll see. But in here is the agreement.
Well, the Washington Post did freeze action it. And you can actually read what it says. Once again, Trump is foiled by his arch nemesis, sunlight and reading.
There's that.
Washington Post analyzed it, and here's what it says. Mexico hereby promises to provide asylum to any U.S. president fleeing the FBI, shall hide him under the name Donaldo El Guapo Trumpistador, and furnish him with unlimited chalupas.
Yeah. That sounds about right. A little bit of Stephen Colbert from last night, just to get the funny on before we launch into today's program, because there's a lot of ground to cover, as I mentioned. We may actually have to run long today. Now, of course, this program airs live. We're doing it live right now at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific, Tuesday through Friday, at NicoleSandler.com, on my TuneIn channel, on YouTube, and I don't know who else carries us live. We are carried by tape delay on the Progressive Voices Network at 10 p.m. Eastern. Just a heads up that perhaps today's show may run a little long. An edited one-hour version will be on the Progressive Voices Network, but the podcast will be the full and unencumbered extended disco version should we run long today. Just warning you, because there's so much to do. By the way, somebody in the YouTube chat room just said, was Trump's son supposed to testify today? Yes, Don Jr. testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee behind closed doors, so we don't know exactly what went on. Don Jr. said that he didn't change anything. One of the reasons why he was subpoenaed or requested, I think it was a subpoena actually, to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. And this is important because the Senate committees are run by the Republicans. So Burr is the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So it was a Republican who was responsible for bringing Don Jr. back in. Again, there were problems. There were questions about his earlier testimony, mostly concerning that June 2016 meeting with Natalia Veselnitskaya and other Russian operatives at Trump Tower again in June. So anyway, I'm sure it'll all eventually come out. And in fact, that was the subject, the Mueller report and the redactions is what I wanted to speak with Jason Leopold about today. Now, in case you're not familiar, and you probably are if you listen to the show, because Jason's an old and dear friend of mine. He's an amazing investigative reporter who's doing incredible work over at BuzzFeed News. He and his reporting partner, Anthony Cormier, broke a lot of stories about the Mueller investigation before the report ever came out. And much of it was confirmed by the report. But Jason and Anthony have been doing a lot of work behind the scenes, so I wanted to check in with him to find out what's going on. I actually spoke with him a couple of hours ago that we recorded, so we'll get to that in a moment. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to chat with Tom Hartman. Yes, Tom Hartman of the Tom Hartman radio program, who has written just about a zillion books, and he has a new one out that's actually, well, I'm not surprised, that's really good. First of all, Randy Watson in the YouTube chat room, your comment just came up, and he wrote, BuzzFeed LOL. While BuzzFeed proper might be, silly lists and stuff, BuzzFeed News is a formidable journalistic endeavor, and I wouldn't LOL at it. BuzzFeed News is doing amazing work, not to be confused with the regular BuzzFeed site, just saying. All right, as you'll hear when we get to Jason Leopold in just a couple of minutes. In fact, you know what, let's do it now. So just a warning, we may run a little long today because there's so much. Oh, well, the thing I neglected to mention is just a few minutes before we hit the air, Bernie Sanders wrapped up a speech, a seminal speech for his campaign that he delivered in D.C. at George Washington University. It began at 2 Eastern, so and it ran for, about 45 minutes. And it was, once again, explaining democratic socialism to the American people. And let me just, I didn't have a chance to really go through it and pull clips. We will get to it later in the week, probably tomorrow. But let me just play you one little clip to give you an example of how Bernie, yes, to Dr. Wood 73 in the YouTube chat room said, killed it. He did kill it. Here's a little bit of Bernie, just a taste, until we can spend more time with him tomorrow.
The Bill of Rights protects us from the tyranny of an oppressive government. many in the establishment would like the American people to submit to the tyranny of oligarchs, multinational corporations, Wall Street banks, and billionaires. It is time, and in fact, time long overdue, for the American people to stand up and fight for their right to freedom,
to party,
human dignity, and security.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good to me.
And that is the core of what my politics and what this campaign is all about. In 1944, FDR proposed an economic bill of rights, but he died a year later and was never able to fulfill that vision. Our job, 75 years later, is to complete what Roosevelt started. And that is why today I am proposing a 21st century economic bill of rights.
Hell yeah. And he went on to say, I am proposing a 21st century economic bill of rights. Every American, regardless of his or her income, is entitled to a decent job that pays a living wage, quality health care, a complete education, affordable housing, a clean environment, and a secure retirement. You know, he framed it as completing FDR's unfinished business. A 21st century Bill of Rights. It was awesome. And again, I will spend some time later today or tomorrow going through it and pulling quotes so we can share more of it with you. I couldn't let today's show go by without dealing with it. And shame, shame, shame on CNN and MSNBC. I understand MSNBC did carry a few minutes of it, so they didn't completely ignore it. But you know that they do on a regular basis. They totally just ignore Bernie Sanders. They act as if he does not exist. I've seen too many of those shows, and yes, I watch it so you don't have to, where they're talking about, you know, Elizabeth Warren is gaining on him, and she couldn't, and Bernie Sanders is completely left out of the conversation. So, yes, they're not going to show it. I will embed, if I can find the entire video, I'm sure I can, in today's blog post at NicoleSandler.com, where I'll post today's program and podcast, which, again, it's the extended version. I can tell you right now we're going to run long. And so the entire show will be posted as the podcast, the abridged version, probably without Jason Leopold, sorry, will air on the Progressive Voices channel. But if you're listening to Progressive Voices, you can come to NicoleSandler.com and download today's podcast. My podcast is always free, by the way, because I run this program sort of like the NPR model. We survive based on your donations, but I'm not going to put up a paywall to keep anyone from listening to the program because I know a lot of people are hurting and can't afford, you know, to spend even $5 a month to get a podcast. So that's why I make it sort of voluntary. All right. So here's what I've decided since it's already 13 minutes after the hour. I did tape with Jason Leopold earlier today, and that interview runs about 20 minutes, and we have Tom Hartman scheduled at the bottom of the hour live. We're going to do it live. So we're going to save Jason's interview for after Tom Hartman. So we will do the extended version today. So in the meantime, why not get to what's news? And I know you love it when we do it live, so...
We'll do it live. Okay. Fucking thing! We'll do it live! Fuck it! I'll write it and we'll do it live!
All right, we'll do it live. So let's first start with the news that broke since I recorded what's news early this morning. The White House today asserted executive privilege regarding documents pertaining to the administration's efforts to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. This obviously a move to block Democrats from investigating the matter. So the House Democrats on the Oversight Committee are, in fact, it's happening right now, a hearing and the vote. Let me see if the vote. Oh, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is speaking. Ew, let's hear what she has to say.
Are not optional guidelines.
This is the House Committee. that's going to vote on whether to hold William Barr and Wilbur Ross in contempt of Congress.
Policies are in place. Right. These guidelines are in place.
Ugh, I can't listen to Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Anyway, they're going to vote there. That's what's going on in the House Oversight Committee. They're going to vote on holding Barr and Ross in contempt for failure to turn over these documents pertaining to the 2020 census in response to congressional subpoenas as the House investigates whether the Trump administration is changing the census to deliberately undercount or disadvantage Democrats or people of color. You think? This is really important. And just know that Friday on this program, Ari Berman will be here. This is his beat. Nobody covers what's going on with the census and voter suppression efforts better than Ari Berman, who these days writes for Mother Jones. So again, he'll be with us on Friday's show. In the meantime, as I mentioned earlier, Donald Trump Jr. testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee this morning. So that's done. I do have the story. And in fact, I'm going to play for you not the entirety of John Stewart's testimony yesterday, which you should watch. In fact, I will post that video on today's blog as well. So if you haven't seen the full 9 minutes or so of John Stewart's emotional and passionate testimony before a House Judiciary Subcommittee about extending the 9/11 First Responders Fund, Victims Fund. You need to see the whole thing. Now, I did edit it down in order to fit it into What's News, just to, because I couldn't let this moment in, you know, the shaming of the American Congress go by without including some of it on the program. So, yeah, we may not have Jon Stewart's biting political comedy and searing commentary on The Daily Show nightly anymore, but thankfully the 9/11 first responders have him in their corner. Now, the Victims Compensation Fund expires in December of next year, of 2020, but is already nearly out of funds. They announced in February that future claims would be paid at a fraction of what the government paid in the past. So this new bill, the proposed Never Forget the Heroes Act, would replenish the 9/11 Compensation Fund through fiscal year 2090. But of course, it struggled to gain momentum in Congress. So John Stewart, again, showed up before this subcommittee yesterday to scold and shame the lawmakers for their disinterest.
The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Thousands more poured in to continue to fight for their brothers and sisters. The breathing problem started almost immediately, and they were told they weren't sick, they were crazy. And then, as the illnesses got worse and things became more apparent, well, okay, you're sick, but it's not from the pile. And then when the science became irrefutable, okay, it's the pile.
Yeah.
But this is a New York issue. I don't know if we have the money. And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry and you should be too. And they're all angry as well.
Now, I'm pausing it for a second. If it seems sped up, it really isn't. What I did was I pulled out a lot of the pauses so I could fit more of John Stewart's powerful words into a shorter amount of time. So that's why it's moving faster. I didn't speed him up at all. I just took out some of the breaths and pregnant pauses. Okay.
And they have every justification to be that way. Your indifference costs these men and women their most valuable commodity, time. The one thing they're running out of, this hearing should be flipped. These men and women should be up on that stage, and Congress should be down here answering their questions as to why this is so damn hard and takes so damn long. Setting aside that no American in this country should face financial ruin because of a health issue, the idea that you can only give them 5 more years of the VCF because you're not quite sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. Well, I can tell you, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. More of these men and women are going to get sick and they are going to die.
Yep.
And I am awfully tired of hearing that it's a 9/11 New York issue. Al-Qaeda didn't shout death to Tribeca. They attacked America. And these men and women and their response to it is what brought our country back. It's what gave a reeling nation a solid foundation to stand back upon, to remind us of why this country is great, of why this country is worth fighting for. And you are ignoring them. Mm. And you can end it tomorrow. Why this bill isn't unanimous consent and a standalone issue is beyond my comprehension. And I have yet to hear a reasonable explanation for why. It'll get stuck in some transportation bill or some appropriations bill and get sent over to the Senate, where a certain someone from the Senate will use it as a political football to get themselves maybe another new import tax on petroleum. Because that's what happened to us in 2015. They responded 5 seconds. They did their jobs with courage, grace, tenacity, humility. 18 years later, do yours. Thank you.
John Stewart, who then got a standing ovation in this House subcommittee hearing room. Interesting remark by you are too in the YouTube chat room. And the Fire Department of New York and NYPD still vote Republican. Law enforcement's going to wise up one of these days and realize that Republicans are not on their side. Anyway, John Stewart, I guess he moved a few people because the House subcommittee that he testified before yesterday voted this morning to advance the bill that would grant additional funding for the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund until 2090. So the bill passed the committee voice vote without opposition. It will now go to the floor for consideration by the entire House. And Mitch McConnell will kill it in the Senate because that's what he does. All the more reason Democrats need to take back the Senate. All right. In other news, you know, again, one of the reasons why I'm so pissed off that neither CNN or MSNBC carried Bernie Sanders' speech live is because they carried Joe Biden's nothing campaign speech from Iowa live the other night. The mainstream media is treating the former Vice President Joe Biden like he's the presumptive Democratic nominee for 2020. Cable News reporting breathlessly Tuesday on the fact that both Biden and Trump would be campaigning in Iowa that night. Biden's camp released the text of a speech he would deliver Tuesday night in which he would eviscerate Trump hours, like 12 hours before the scheduled speech time. Cable News dutifully reported about it all day and then actually streamed this rally live. It was a campaign stop. There was nothing special about this speech. Now, let me just say, Jeb Bush and Rudy Giuliani would like to remind you that the front runner at this point in the race rarely wins the nomination. The first debate between the Democratic candidates is 2 weeks from tonight, just in case you were wondering. By the way, a new national poll from Quinnipiac shows Biden trouncing Trump by 13 points in a head-to-head matchup, but five other Democratic contenders, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and Cory Booker, also beat Donald Trump easily in that matchup. In other news, the House voted yesterday to authorize its committees to sue the Trump administration and others in pursuit of witnesses and documents for their investigation into Trump. The resolution empowers the House committee chairman to act on their own to file suit in order to enforce the subpoenas that they issue in their investigations. They'd be permitted to act without a full vote of the House, which supporters say would keep the chamber clearer to both investigate and legislate. Good! It's about time! So House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler told MSNBC's Ari Melber last night that there is progress in negotiation to bring Mueller in to testify.
You've also been negotiating with now former special counsel Mueller. Has he agreed to come in voluntarily? Is there a date by which, if he does not, you would subpoena him?
Well, we're carrying on conversations with him, and he will come in, and if we have to subpoena him, we will.
Would that be, say, by the end of the summer if he doesn't come in?
Oh, I would think it would be way before that.
Way before that, by the end of June?
I'm not going to comment. I don't know.
Okay. So way before the end of summer, but he's not commenting on the end of June, which after all is only, what, 17, 18 days away. I'm guessing July, probably July. It's about time. Bring him in. There is other news going on today. For instance, thousands of protesters blocked entry to Hong Kong's government headquarters yesterday and pretty much brought central Hong Kong to a standstill, delaying a legislative session on a proposed extradition bill that has heightened fears over greater Chinese control and erosion of civil liberties in Hong Kong, which is a semi-autonomous territory. Police responded to the protests by firing rubber bullets and tear gas. Critics say the bill will make anyone in Hong Kong susceptible to being grabbed and sent to mainland China for political reasons. They also say it undermines Hong Kong's semi-autonomous legal system. Chinese officials say the bill just plugs some loopholes in the country's extradition law. Right. It should be noted that the anniversary of the uprising at Tiananmen Square was just this week. It was like, what, 40 or a lot of years ago. China blocked CNN, blocked all coverage of what happened at Tiananmen Square from being shown to the people in China. You know, things are bad here. Just lets you know how much worse they could be. All right. We still have a couple of minutes before it's time to call Tom Hartman, and I don't want to call him early. There is actually one more story. Shoot, I thought I copied it over, but I didn't. Let me see if I can remember enough. The Trump administration, you know, keeps rounding up migrants. We've heard all about it, right? What you may not have heard is they are now looking at using the facilities that were used as Japanese internment camps during World War II to house some of these migrants who come here seeking asylum and are turned into criminals by the Trump administration. Amazing. I'll tell you what, before we get to Tom Hartman, let me play for you just another clip of Bernie Sanders from earlier today when he talks about the reality of the situation we're now living.
Today, we have a demagogue in the White House who, for cheap political gain, is attempting to deflect the attention of the American people away from the real crises that we face, and instead is doing what demagogues always do, and that is to divide people up and legislate hatred. This is a president who supports brutal family separations,
yep,
border walls,
yep,
Muslim bans, anti-LGBT policies, deportations, and voter suppression. It is my very strong belief that the United States must reject that path of hatred and divisiveness and instead find the moral conviction to choose a different path, a higher path, a path of compassion, justice, and love.
Sounds good to me. I cut down the applause, I think, so he should come back on in a second.
And that is the path that I call democratic socialism.
It makes sense to me. Democratic socialism is not socialism. And for all the critics out there who are saying, you know, Bernie can't be the nominee because Trump will eviscerate him by calling him a socialist, Trump will call Joe Biden a socialist. Trump will call Cory Booker a socialist. It doesn't matter who the Democratic nominee is. The Republicans will label that person a socialist. They labeled Barack Obama a socialist. They said he was the most liberal senator in the U.S. Senate when he was running in 2008. And we all know that that is
bullshit.
It's bullshit. Barack Obama was a centrist, is a centrist. So is Joe Biden. So it doesn't matter if it's Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. I'll take either one of them. Even though I've got concerns, we'll address them as the months go on. We've got a lot of time. Even if they pick the most centrist, the most conservadem of the Democratic candidates, they're still going to call that person a socialist. Donald Trump calls it the Socialist Democrat Party. Again, don't let that dissuade you from voting for Bernie Sanders. And again, if you listen to his speech today on what is democratic socialism, you'll understand he's basically touting FDR's New Deal. And Harvey J.K., professor of freedom and democracy at University of Wisconsin in Green Bay, and the author of a book on the four freedoms on FDR, will be with us next week, I think on Wednesday. So we'll go into greater depth about Bernie's speech and what comes next. All right. We're going to change gears now. And, let me call Tom Hartman. I don't know if he's aware that, you know, I do sort of guerrilla radio, and I'm on my own here. On my own. I'm the host, the producer, the engineer, the call screener, everything else. And, So, we'll call him live on the air so he knows, you know, that we're on. I don't want to, like, keep him on hold and not say, you know, hi, Tom, when he answers the phone. So hopefully we're calling one ringy dingy. Usually I do this in the background so you don't hear the ringing. All right. I know he knows we're calling today. I think he knows we're calling today. All right. Well, this is interesting. All right, I'm going to try to call again. This is, you know, live radio. It's so much fun, isn't it? Did I dial it right? Okay. I don't know why he is not answering. Let's try it again. Oh, I just love doing this. Yes, Tom is doing a book signing this evening in Portland. His new book, as you can see if you're watching on YouTube, is The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. Well, you know what? We may not have Tom Hartman today. I did reconfirm it with his publicist. I wonder. Let me try to call the other line and see if that works, even though this is the line they said to call on. We'll try it this way. See, the other one didn't even sound like it was ringing, did it? I don't know. No, the professor wasn't on hold. I know, this is great radio, isn't it? In the extended version, in the podcast, I'll edit this all out. All right, I don't know what to do about Tom Hartman. I'll tell you what we'll do is, and I didn't edit the date out, but I'll tell you what, we will check in with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen and the Green News Report while I try to figure out what is happening with Tom Hartman. Because he should know better than that. He knows. He does this job for a living. All right. Back in a moment, either with Tom Hartman or Jason Leopold. Either way, it'll be interesting. I promise you that much. We'll be right back. Nicole Sandler, NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It's Tuesday, June 11, 2019.
Two words that get the attention of most national security professionals are uncertainty and surprise. And climate change will bring significant amounts of both.
Surprise! White House censors intelligence officials' congressional testimony on climate change. India's deadly heat wave triggers water conflicts. Canada to ban single-use plastic nationwide. Plus,
we can't wait to act.
Former New York mayor launches Beyond Carbon Initiative to fight climate change.
All of those fights and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Tornadoes. I don't remember tornadoes in the U.S. to the extent. But then when you look back, 40 years ago, we had the worst tornado binge that we've ever had.
You know, a tornado binge. Who hasn't gone out for a tornado and had a few too many?
This is your Green News Report.
Man, what did we do last night? Why does my mouth taste like a flat trailer park?
I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, after weeks and weeks and weeks of terrible weather news in the central U.S., good news is it's clearing up. Bad news, all of that terrible weather has moved to the southeast, where in some places they got a month's worth of rain in one single day
yes.
over the weekend?
Yes, and of course that forced evacuations and high water rescues, and that's exactly in line with observed data that shows heavy rainfall events have already increased in the United States since the 1950s.
Well, a foot of rain in a single day, why worry?
But it's the opposite problem in India, where a persistent near-record heat wave has killed hundreds of people and triggered water shortages. Temperatures as high as 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Officials have ordered police escorts for all water tankers and guards at water sources after multiple stabbings and assaults in communities.
All right,
that
I am going to interrupt the Green News Report. We will get back to Brad and Desi because I believe... I think we have Tom Hartman on the line. Tom, you there?
Indeed, you
yay,
do.
Yay! Yay!
I love you, Nicole.
Oh, you know, I usually can pull off a radio show being the host, the producer, the engineer, and you know, chief cook and bottle washer. Occasionally, have a technical problem. Like now, but you know, that's what happens when you have a radio show put together with spit and chewing gum. But we're here.
Yep.
Tom Hartman is with us. You know Tom Hartman and have listened to him for years, doing the most listened to progressive radio show in the country. My acquaintance with Tom Hartman goes back many years, back to the Air America days. Even before that, actually, when Tom was on Air America and I was doing mornings at a station here in Miami that somebody brought up on Twitter this morning. Anyway, Tom has, in addition
and
to...
you used to fill in for him.
And I used to fill in for you.
Such a great job.
Oh, thank you so much. In addition to hosting a very busy and informative radio program every day, you're the author of what, 538 books? Something like that?
I think I think it's 29 right now.
It seems more than that. In fact, at the end of the new book, which is wonderful, by the way, it's called The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. In the back, there's a page. It says books by Tom Hartman. And it just, it's impressive. You know, as someone who struggles with writing a blog post every day, I'm in awe. And I think the first book that I read by you was years ago when I was struggling with my daughter's ADHD, and you've written books on that subject as well. So thanks for informing us for so many years.
In fact, FYI, that first book that I wrote on ADD, A Different Perception, uh-huh. which is kind of the classic book, I just updated that. And added two new chapters, one in particular on the problem that ADHD people have getting a good night's sleep. And that's coming out, ADHD, A Hunter in a Farmer's World. But it's available for pre-order, you know, wherever you buy your books.
Oh, great, because I found it very helpful. My daughter is now 20 and dealing with it, but, you know, life goes on.
Great.
Anyway, the new book... The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, in danger of sounding like I'm gushing, I got to say, this book is written so beautifully. As somebody who I get fatigued reading a lot of nonfiction, like reading the Mueller Report, that can be dry and sort of bogged down in details. This book, I started reading it, I really couldn't put it down. And it really lays out the history of guns in America and the Second Amendment, and basically how we got to where we are. And it's something that I knew, but the way you put it in such succinct and easy-to-understand language, it all falls together. And basically, you tell the story of how the gun culture that we don't enjoy in this country all dates back to racism and slavery.
Yeah, and genocide.
And genocide.
You know, the United States... and Britain before, it was the official policy of Britain for 200 years. And then when we became a country, the official policy of the United States, right up until, you know, roughly the turn of the 20th century, it was genocide. It was to exterminate Native Americans. And so, you know, that extermination was facilitated by guns, the technology of guns, and then the institution of slavery. Slavery is only possible in the context of a police state. You have to have a police state to have slavery. And we certainly had one here in the United States. The well-regulated militias that the Second Amendment refers to in the South were also called slave patrols.
Right. Right. And you I just actually finished reading the part about the writing of the Second Amendment, which was the language about the well-regulated militia. It was put there specifically to appease the Southern slave owners who used those militias to keep their slaves in line. It was a compromise to get them on board, I guess, with this the new Constitution. But it when you just read it, in the historical perspective that you place it in, it's just really depressing. You know, we've been told this country was founded on great ideas and opposition to a state religion. When we find out it was basically based on a genocide and slavery. And it all boils down to guns, and it leads to where we are today. You know, Tom, I don't know if you know that I live in Coral Springs, Florida. We are right next door to Parkland. We share a fire department and a police department with Parkland. So our community was devastated last year. And, you know, we watch these school shootings unfold on an all too regular basis. But when it happens to your community, you think the pain can't get worse than seeing it from afar until you see it close up and you run into people every day who were family members who were, you know, directly impacted. You know somebody who was either killed or had somebody very close to them murdered by a crazy person with a gun in a school where it shouldn't be. You know, the question is, now that the Democrats have control of the House and they actually passed the first gun control bill in decades, I believe, are they doing enough? I know they can't get it through the Senate, but have they done enough?
Well, the starting point that they're doing is, you know, expanding background checks to everybody in the country, eliminating the gun show loophole, and outlawing things like bump stocks that turn semi-automatic weapons into fully automatic weapons for all practical purposes, and regulating things like oversized clips and silencers. That's a great start. But I think that, you know, the principal suggestion that I lay out in the end of the book is that we regulate guns the same way we regulate cars.
Mm-hmm.
In 1920, you could buy a car and you could drive it anywhere you want without a driver's license, without insurance, without having to register the car. And a lot of people started dying as there became more and more cars on the road. And so, you know, we collectively got together and said, we need to have well-regulated cars, right? And how do we do that? Well, we came up with this three-part thing. Number one, from the time it's made until the time it's destroyed, it's registered. There's a VIN number. Guns have serial numbers. And every year you have to renew that registration with the local state that you live in. Number two, you have to prove to a state official that you actually know how to drive and that you know the laws, you know the rules. So there's a driving test and a written test. We could do the same thing for guns. In fact, many states, not quite a majority of states, require that same kind of thing in order to get a concealed carry permit. And then, and so we should just extend that to anybody who wants a gun. It's not onerous. You know, we go through this to get a driver's license. And then number three, liability insurance. I think it's insane that those Parkland kids were slaughtered. And had they been killed by somebody who was driving even maliciously, you know, if they had been in the street and he had come along and plowed them down with an SUV, you know, Geico would be paying $1 million to each one of the families. But because they were filled with guns, they didn't even get burial expenses. They got nothing. Bupkis. And these are families that are devastated by this.
Yeah.
So and that liability insurance is the free market solution that every Republican should salute, because, you know, the government is really not all that good at anticipating crime, at figuring out who's most likely to be a criminal. We don't want the government to be particularly good at that. I mean, that's pretty intrusive stuff. That's their business. I mean, if you buy life insurance, that rate based on how likely they think you are to die. You buy health insurance, they're going to set that rate based on how likely you are to get sick.
Sure.
And if you buy car insurance, they're going to base it on how likely you are to get in an accident. And they've got, you know, ways to figure this out. And it's the same thing with guns. And so here's your free market solution. Somebody's got a couple of domestic violence convictions. Sure, we'll write insurance for you and your gun. It'll be $25,000 a year.
Right.
On the other hand, you got somebody who has a history of being a responsible citizen. Sure, we'll write, you know, liability insurance for you and your gun for $300 a year. I mean, it doesn't need to be particularly expensive. They've been offering liability insurance for gun owners for decades now already. let's just make it mandatory.
Absolutely.
Just like with cars.
Absolutely. And it makes so much sense. And, you know, it doesn't have to be an either or. There's always Chris Rock's idea of charging $5,000 a bullet. If you make them so expensive, people can't afford them. But it should all be regulated. That's the thing. Have we always had this Wild West attitude towards gun regulations? I mean, were they? It's fascinating. I mean, reading the history. For instance, I didn't know that in the Civil War era, the price of a gun was akin to what the price of a car is now to us. That they were that expensive,
Or even a home.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Because guns were, you know, they were made one at a time. They were precision instruments. They had to be made very, very well, or, you know, you could blow your hand up if they misfired. And so they were very expensive. And then Colt came along in the 1830s and started mass producing them. And the quality was not all that good. So the government stopped buying them. He reinvented the money from Eli Whitney, the guy who invented the cotton gin, who was, you know, that era's big billionaire. And they rolled this out in the 1850s and just in time to plop, you know, people in the Civil War.
Right.
But, guns have it's a fascinating history. But you asked, you know, has it always been this way? No.
Yeah.
Actually, until the mid-1970s, the NRA was in favor of gun control.
Wow.
You know, and it wasn't until they got taken over basically by the weapons manufacturing industry that they dropped their position that they were in favor of gun control and instead said that they were opposed to any kind of gun control. So, Reagan was in favor of gun control. In fact, he signed the Mumford bill that started when Huey Newton and Bobby Seale showed up at the state capitol in California with unloaded guns. But, you know, Reagan didn't know that. Reagan was out talking to a bunch of school kids. And here, a couple of black guys get out of a car with guns and walk up into the main part of the state capitol. And Reagan and his buddies, of course, just freaked out. And within a few weeks, they had legislation on the floor to end open carry in California, which gives you a clue as to how racist, you know, the racial tone of all this stuff. I mean,
always.
But there was a broad consensus, and it passed a. The assault weapon ban is what they called it. There was like 70-80% support for that. And in fact, that support continued right up 2006 when George W. Bush decided not to renew it because of, you know, all the money that he and the GOP were taking from the NRA.
Amazing. And so when did the Heller Supreme Court ruling come into play that really redefined the Second Amendment? Because until Heller, if I understand history correctly, and I haven't gotten through the whole book yet, so I still have a lot to learn. There were reasonable controls on guns. It wasn't considered the well-regulated militia wasn't considered each one of us, right? It didn't mean the average person on the street had the right to carry a gun.
Yeah, 2 points. Number one, the whole militia idea came out of at the Constitution, you know, when the Constitution was being written, the founders, and there was a broad consensus about this. This was not a radical position. They did not want the United States to have a standing army during time of peace. They wanted the army to dissolve, except for when it was in war. And that's why in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, there are no limits on how long Congress.
You're breaking up on me.
Army can only be funded for. So you've got that, and then the Second Amendment as well was you know, about the militia. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. No, you broke up a little bit.
Okay.
On the cell phone. Yeah, so with Heller, things sort of changed, and the meaning of the Second Amendment changed. And unfortunately, with the makeup of the Supreme Court as it is now, I don't see this being changed, the opinion in Heller, anytime, certainly not in my lifetime.
Yeah, Scalia essentially invented this individual right to own a gun for self-defense. You know, many of the founders were in favor of having guns for self-defense, you know, but they weren't putting it into law, and that was not their goal in writing the Second Amendment. And you read the dissents in the Heller case, where the four dissenting Supreme Court justices pointed out the fraud of what Scalia was promoting. it's pretty clear. In fact, I quote from those dissents in the book, in the Hidden History book. So, but Heller really changed things in a substantial way. But even with the Heller decision, my suggestion that we regulate guns like cars, that's perfectly compatible with the Heller decision. There's a lot that we can do, even given what we have.
Well, it makes complete sense. I mean, and the car is a great analogy because, you know, you don't have to have one, but if you want to use one, you get trained to operate one, and you get licensed and registered and insured to operate one. So it works. The difference is, though, the only purpose for a gun is to kill somebody or something. I mean, it's a killing machine. The main purpose of a car is transportation. I think that's even more reason to regulate the guns. The NRA is the entity here that's standing between any sensible gun regulations and reality. But the NRA is having troubles these days, aren't they?
Yeah, although let me qualify that. Okay. It's not just the NRA. The gun manufacturers themselves, independent of the NRA, for years have been pouring money into the campaign coffers and into individual PACs that are not the NRA to support principally Republicans, but a few Democrats as well, who are in favor of not having any kind of gun regulation in the United States. The NRA is having problems right now. And I think that they're going through the same thing the tobacco lobby did in the late 90s when, as a result of all those lawsuits, we discovered that for years and years they had been lying to us about what they knew about tobacco, how, you know, 500,000 Americans were dying every year because of tobacco. My own father, I think, died because of tobacco, in part anyway. Americans responded with revulsion as a result of the things that came out of those lawsuits in the late 90s. And so, you know, in 1995, the tobacco industry was arguably the most powerful industry in Congress, maybe outside of the defense industry. By 2001 or 2002, the tobacco lobby was just another lobby. And, you know, I think that same thing is happening with the NRA now, as more and more people are realizing what a scam it is, you know, how they've been hustling money for each other, how corrupt the NRA is. But beyond that, are also realizing that our gun laws are just nuts. I mean, you know, this idea that just anybody can show up at a gun show and you know, plop down some cash and walk off with a gun that can be, with a bump stock, turned into a fully automatic weapon, as we saw with the shooter in Las Vegas. I mean, he shot, what, 500 people?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know,
yep.
He killed over 100.
Yep.
That's nuts, right? There should not be weapons of war on the streets of America.
No,
that's what it boils down
fully,
to.
Fully agree. And, you know, since Heller, we've seen this resurgence. I guess it is, since the assault weapons ban was in effect for 10 years and then came back. But this new preponderance of just these AR-15s everywhere, that people think they're, you know, for sport. These are weapons of war. These are war.
That's right.
Machine guns. They are machine guns. That's what they are. I
grew up in Michigan, and half my friends went hunting every winter. You know, it's I knew the gun culture and the hunting culture really well. One of my brothers is a gun enthusiast, and I can tell you, you know, if anybody when I was a kid, if anybody had gone out in the woods with a machine gun or a semi-automatic gun. Something like an AR-15 to hunt deer, they would have been laughed
right.
out of, you know, they, people would have ridiculed them.
Right. Hunting's supposed to be sort of a fair fight, right? We're speaking with Tom Hartmann. His brand new book is The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. The introduction, you tell a fascinating story, but we've heard this story. It was 2008. You went to a shooting range with your brother and some family members to shoot, and you encountered a shooting range owner or worker who told you could only buy one box of ammunition because there was a shortage because of the black guy that was elected who was coming to take your guns. This was a big deal during the Obama years. The NRA spread this rumor that Obama's going to take your guns. As far as I know, he really didn't do anything on gun control, did he?
No. Well, the two things Obama did is he allowed guns on Amtrak and he allowed guns in national parks.
Right. Yeah,
so,
thank you so much.
It's not quite taking your guns away, right?
No.
But I think the Amtrak, I'm certain about the national parks.
Oh, yes.
There was some change in the rules around Amtrak. In fact, the guy at the shooting range, I said, you know, why is this? Why this? I mean, they were almost out of ammunition. This is a giant shooting range that, you know, one of the largest in the state that typically has thousands of boxes of ammunition. They were down to a couple hundred. And I said, why? And he pulls his smartphone out of his pocket and shows me an email that he got from, you know, some organization. And it looked credible. I mean, the way it was put together, like a news report that, you know, starting this, I keep in mind, this was Christmas of 2008. So this was about 3 weeks before Barack Obama was inaugurated. And in it, it said that on January 25th, as I recall, you know, a week after he was inaugurated, that Obama already had this plan in place to have the ATF go door to door, kick in people's doors, look for their guns. If they have the guns, take them off and put the people in FEMA camps and steal their guns. And literally millions of Americans believed this, to the point that there's a Wikipedia page for the great ammunition shortages of 2008 and 2012, the 2 years that Barack Obama won election.
Wow.
You know, having a black man in the White House was such a, you know, it made these white gun enthusiasts so hysterical that literally it was a nationwide ammunition shortage.
Right. And gun sales surged because people were afraid they weren't going to be able to buy a gun. Conversely, when Trump was elected, there were no such fears and gun sales plummeted. Is that a reason, one of the reasons why the NRA is hurting now, or is it goes beyond that?
Absolutely. No, it's absolutely the case. The NRA is having a hard time. They were having an easy time raising money as long as people were afraid of Obama, that he was going to do gun control. And if they get a Democratic president, they'll do it again. I mean, Obama was a twofer. He was a Democrat and he was also African-American. So they could push both those buttons. But, if the next president is a woman, they'll try pushing that button. I mean, we'll see.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a person of color. I mean, we've got some very good candidates, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris. So, you know, Andrew Yang, we'll see how it shakes out. But I think the NRA's time has passed.
Well, so do I, more than. So hopefully we'll see the demise of the NRA. They sunk $30 million into supporting Donald Trump, his candidacy, an amount that they had never spent before. Hopefully that'll hasten their demise.
Money that they apparently laundered from Russia.
Oh, it just gets better and better, doesn't it?
We
are living in most unconceivable story. I would talk about this all the time, where if somebody wrote a screenplay and set up American society as it is today, the studios would all reject it with a laugh and saying that's so implausible that, you know, go away, come back when you have something realistic.
Truth is stranger than fiction is true.
No kidding. So Tom Hartman, again, not only do you have the book, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, it's out now. You're speaking, doing an in-store tonight in Portland, where you live. I've been hearing you talk about it. You also are involved in a new movie that premiered on HBO last night, aren't you?
That's right. And if you're not an HBO subscriber, you can watch it tonight for free at HBO Go and HBO Now. It's called Ice on Fire. And I helped put the movie together. Louise and I went to Norway and Costa Rica for filming of it, among other places. I'm in the movie a few times. Leo DiCaprio produced it and narrates it brilliantly, I would add. And if you know anybody who doesn't understand what the issue is around climate science, or even is skeptical of it, or thinks that maybe it's all a hoax, this is the movie they have to watch. It's only an hour and a half long. It is brilliantly photographed. It's not at all boring. It's a very exciting movie. And it's solid. You're going to love it, Nicole. You're just going to love it.
Great. I recorded it today. So, hopefully we'll watch it tonight or over the weekend. So it is there on HBO. I remember I heard you talk about it yesterday and I forgot last night. So I just set up the DVR and recorded it there. I want to, your book, this is The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment. But is this the start of a new series? You've got one coming out about the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's available for pre-order from any bookstore or, you know, Amazon or Powell's or whatever, you know, wherever you like to buy your books. And that's the second one. That'll be out this fall. It's The Hidden History of the Supreme Court of the Betrayal of America. And then in the spring, there's a book coming out called The Hidden History of the Republican War on Voting. And then a year from next spring, we're not going to do the fall of 2020 because it would just, you know, so much going on with the election. But the one after that is The Hidden History of Monopoly and and the mirage of capitalism. We haven't quite figured out the title for that, and that book's only about half written right now.
Wow.
But the other three are all written and, in the conveyor belt.
Okay. Well, a lot to look forward to from Tom Hartmann, in addition to the radio show that you can hear noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, at TomHartmann.com, of course, on XM, on Free Speech TV. You're everywhere, aren't you, Tom?
Except on all these, little radio stations that are entirely right wing all across the
Heartland. Well, that's a topic for another day that we could talk at length about the demise of our industry, which is just really a shame. I could go on ad nauseum about that. Anyway, Tom Hartmann, again, find him on the radio, find him at your local bookstore or at the library, on HBO. You are everywhere, and we're thankful for that. Tom Hartmann, one last question for you. I know you don't like listeners calling into your radio show and maybe criticizing any of the Democratic candidates. Are you leaning towards anyone right now?
No. If they resurrected Democrat, I'd vote for him.
If they resurrected who? Trump. You just broke up. I said I'd vote for my dog Jackson over Donald Trump. That goes without saying.
Yeah,
but I'm not asking you who it is. I'm just asking if you have a candidate.
There's a couple of candidates that I prefer, and you can probably figure out who they are. They're the most progressive ones.
I like.
They win,
I'm sure.
Whoever wins.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm in the Bernie or Elizabeth Warren camp all the way. And we'll leave it at that. Tom Hartmann, thank you so much. I'm really enjoying the book. As I said, I'm about halfway done with it, and I highly recommend it because it's a great primer on our history of guns in this country. And frankly, we all need to be on the front line fighting against the proliferation of guns, and this arms you with great, I'm sorry to use all the gun,
metaphors.
Yes, but it works. Be armed with information. It's your best defense against anyone. And there's a lot of great information
there.
Go. Thank you so much, Tom Hartmann.
Thanks so much. Nicole,
take care.
For having me on your show.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. There's Tom Hartmann, everybody. As somebody in the chat room said, whether you agree with him or not, Tom Hartmann is always interesting. And my God, he's got a lot of information up there. All right. Now, I told you I spoke with Jason Leopold earlier this morning. Jason Leopold, for those who don't know, I think is one of our country's best investigative journalists. Yes, it's the extended disco version of the Nicole Sandler Show today. We're running long just because there was a lot of stuff to get through. And so I spoke with Jason Leopold earlier today. He is these days the senior investigative reporter at BuzzFeed News. As I mentioned earlier, don't confuse BuzzFeed News with BuzzFeed. They're two separate entities. And BuzzFeed News has done some amazing investigative journalism, especially since Jason Leopold came on board. Anyway, he, throughout the time of the Mueller investigation, was breaking news after news, story after story. In fact, the one time the Mueller team commented on a news story was to say that something that Jason and his writing partner, Anthony Cormier, wrote was incorrect. We later found out it was exactly correct. I still don't understand exactly what made them come out and speak against this piece, but some bit of information they got, I guess, freaked the investigators out, because how did these two guys from BuzzFeed News get this information? But it was proved to be accurate. They were vindicated in their coverage. Anyway, I wanted to know where Jason is. I know he's been using FOIA. He's been labeled the FOIA terrorist by the government. And I just saw an email popped up on my screen and it distracted me. I wanted to know, I know they put in FOIA requests to get all of the information that, for instance, Gerald Nadler has been subpoenaing using a different method to try to get the information. So I wanted an update. And for that, I called on my pal, Jason Leopold. On the line with us now is my dear friend, Jason Leopold. He's a senior investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News and, as usual, stirring up all kinds of shit. Hey there, Jason.
Hey, Nicole. Great to be with you.
It's always great to talk to you. So you and your writing partner, Anthony Cormier, have been doing great work on trying to uncover all the stuff that's still hidden from us about the Mueller report. In fact, your latest piece up at BuzzFeed News has to do with the Justice Department clarifying why it redacted the Mueller report. Did they? I mean, do we know their reasonings for the redaction? So what have we learned? What have you learned?
Yeah, no, just by way of background, let me just explain what we did on that.
Okay.
So prior to the release of the Mueller report, right, before we actually knew that Robert Mueller was going to release the report, that he was actually done, I had filed a FOIA request with the Justice Department requesting access the release of the Mueller report. Weirdly, 2 days later, there was an announcement Robert Mueller was done with the report, and that obviously it would be released in some form around that time. So I still kept my Freedom of Information Act request active. And the reason why I did that, BuzzFeed and I ended up suing the Justice Department for access to the Mueller report, even though they were going to release it publicly. The reason I did that, and I may have explained this, when we spoke previously, but forgive me, I don't remember. Mm. But the reason is because we want to be able to challenge the redactions that the Justice Department made to the Mueller report, right? So the report has some significant redactions in it. Now, the Freedom of Information Act allows us to actually challenge those redactions in litigation. We actually can say, hey, government, we want you to justify this. And so that's what we did. And what happened is maybe about a month ago, the Justice Department released another version of the Mueller report. Mm. And that version of the Mueller report was redacted again, but it was redacted in accordance with the 9 exemptions under FOIA, under the Freedom of Information Act. And so what that does is that it gives insight into what the reasons and rationale that the government has for some of those redactions, right? There are some redactions that, rise to the level of national security,
right.
Ongoing investigations, mm-hmm. Grand jury material, privacy. So now we can say, hey, look, we want to challenge this. We think this should be unredacted. And then as this case now is kind of going forward, the government has to respond. They have to say, well, here's why we redacted this. So earlier this month, about a week ago, an attorney in the Justice Department submitted a declaration into U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. in response to, our case, explaining in greater detail what these redactions are. Essentially, what is really behind the redactions? What's the information that, characterizing what the information is behind the redactions? So that gives, people who are closely watching and are interested, obviously, in the, in the investigation and what was happening during the investigation and what's currently happening, it gives greater insight into what's there. And so what was there, what she essentially said is there are a number of investigations that are continuing, that are being conducted by the Justice Department National Security Division, U.S. Attorney's offices. She said that some of the redactions also consist of, Bob Mueller and the prosecutions, why they decided to prosecute some individuals and why they decided not to prosecute other individuals.
I'd like to know that.
And that's amazing, right?
Yeah,
we'd like to know that.
Yes.
What was their rationale? In another characterization of what was redacted, she said that there were unwitting individuals who were caught up in Russia's attempts to influence the election through social media, right? They found mm-hmm. themselves being part of a Facebook group. So she even said that they redacted the identity of a specific Facebook group. That's new information.
Yes.
We didn't know that before.
Right.
Because these individuals are part of it. And the argument is that if they were to unredact that, it would somehow, violate their privacy. But again, this is sort of like where I also, am trying to chip away using the tools that we have at our disposal, which is the Freedom of Information Act, to get a better understanding to what went on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is part of a larger effort. Last week, BuzzFeed and I filed our fourth Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Justice Department, the FBI, the NSA, and a number of other agencies to gain access to all of the underlying documents that went into the drafting of the report.
Right.
But even more than that, the ethical guidance, right, that was shared with, say, Attorney General William Barr or other individuals in the Justice Department, discussions revolving around this Office of Legal Counsel memo that says that, you know, a president can't be charged, right? That's something
sitting
that
president
he
can't be indicted, yeah.
So we're asking for that memo. We're asking for the discussions around the memo. Essentially, you know, what we hope to do, and this is really a long game, you know, no one should expect that this will come out tomorrow.
Right.
But the long game is that we want to craft a narrative eventually. We want to be able to provide another narrative that would kind of show this is what was going on behind the scenes. This is what these FBI 302s, which are, you know, summaries of interviews with witnesses, actually say. Obviously, Mueller couldn't fit everything into the report, right? It's a 400-plus page report. Yeah. So you can imagine with a million pages of documents that they summarize what they summarized. We want to be able to tell a larger story. And, you know, this is something that I did when the Senate Intelligence Committee in 2014 released their report on the CIA's torture program.
Right.
So when the Senate Intelligence Committee released their report on the CIA's torture program, they created a narrative. And the narrative said that this was, you know, this was a program that was, you know, far more brutal than we were led to believe, and that the efficacy of the use of these techniques did not result in any sort of, you know, actionable intelligence. But within that 500-page executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report, there were hundreds and hundreds of footnotes.
Right.
I then filed Freedom of Information Act requests with the CIA and then sued them to gain access to all those footnotes,
And I saw your tweet from yesterday. You wrote, "It's really unbelievable that I waited 5 years for this, but I am patient AF." And you retweeted your other tweet about the FOIA contracts you got that show that it says two architects of CIA's torture program received $80 million for their work.
$80 million for the work, exactly. So that was a figure that was included in the report, but now I have the underlying source documents that I can actually share with people and show, like, hey, this is true. This is what it was. And, you know, that has a different kind of impact.
Yes.
So this is exactly what I did back then. I gained access to lots and lots of records from the CIA that were footnoted in that report in an effort to tell a larger story, right? So that's what we're doing here. And we really, you know, because this is not just Mueller's report and an investigation. This is historic.
Yes.
And, you know, what's really, really important right now is that we have one single document. It's that report. And, you know, there's some records that have been trickling out here and there. But because of the historical value of this, it's crucial that these records come out and that the public really get an understanding of what was happening behind the scenes. And I think that they're, you know, seeing Mueller's statement, hearing what he had to say, raised a lot of questions. There's obviously still a lot of questions about, you know, William Barr. What was he doing? Why was he doing this? Why did he, you know, decide to come out with this 4-page memo? We want those records. We want those emails. We want those discussions behind the scenes. We want to know what they were discussing, what they were contemplating. And so this is a real painstaking effort to do that. Right now, that's kind of the bulk of the work that we're doing.
You know, Jason Leopold is with us from BuzzFeed News. You know, it's interesting. So you're going through the FOIA process to try to get at these underlying documents and support materials for the report. It's what the House Judiciary Committee has been trying to get at using subpoenas, and the Trump administration is blocking them. So you're using another avenue, which is available to journalists that, of course, Jason Leopold, you've gained a reputation for being the best at it, using FOIA to get this information. The Intel Committee's torture report, this stuff you waited 5 years for that you just received. So this is really the long game. Let me ask you this about the report, because you did extensive reporting breaking news, making news on what the Mueller investigation found before we got to see the report. I believe the report pretty much backed up your reporting. Did you learn anything new, or did it just basically verify the reporting that you did before?
Yeah, you know, there were some instances where it verified our previous reporting. I mean, certainly on everything that we discussed related to the Trump Tower Moscow negotiation, it laid bare exactly what we, you know, what we had previously reported. In fact, many of the footnotes revolving around those discussions with Michael Cohen, with Felix Sater, with Donald Trump and others, we had actually, you know, released those documents. Those documents that are footnoted in Mueller's report, we had possession of those documents.
Wow.
And in February, we released it all. So it does back it up. I think what was, you know, in terms of what was new, it was certainly, and again, focusing on Trump Tower Moscow negotiations, because that is one of the issues, if you will, that take center stage in this report. It's something that I think may be mentioned more than anything.
Wow.
Anything else in the report. I saw that sort of that statistic or that fact floating around out there. I haven't personally verified it, so.
Right.
I saw some reporters noting that. But what was new about that was the discussions that Jay Sekulow, even though he's not named in the report, apparently had with Michael Cohen about about his testimony to Congress, right? And it was footnoted in there the number of phone conversations that they had, the length of the phone conversations, the effort to, you know, that which the Trump and Sekulow and others in that camp put pressure on Michael Cohen to lie to Congress, to essentially stick to the script. That was new, but what is really noteworthy to me is what wasn't in the report, right? And that's certainly based on a lot of our reporting as well. And we noted this throughout the course of 2 years, particularly when we were following the money, because we did a lot of reporting on the financial machinations and the questionable financial activity revolving around some of the key players. So we're interested in what was not included in the report. Certainly the report backs up what reasonable people can, you know, obviously disagree, but backs up what was reported by us at BuzzFeed and others in the media. But I think that there's a number of questions that I have about why wasn't this included in the report?
Yeah.
And so that's another reason why we want those underlying records. And look, you know, it's a critical document. And in this sort of time that we're living in where things that are so explosive kind of just break at a moment's notice and people take to social media, particularly Twitter, where a lot of news breaks and discussions immediately take place. It's amazing that not many people actually read the report.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a
lengthy report.
Yeah.
It's obviously a dense read, but it's not the document that, you know, the public probably is, you know, consumed, and frankly, journalists and lawmakers have either. So there's quite a bit of analysis and discussion around it without actually reading it.
Right. Well,
what
let
was
me
amazing?
Ask
you, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask about Mueller resisting testifying. Doesn't that go with the job? I mean, he oversaw this investigation for 2 years and put out a report. Obviously, as you said, Jason Leopoldi, not everything can get in the report. And there are a lot of questions about not only what's in it, but what was left out of it. I think it goes with the job to finish the job he started, that it's only right that he testify before Congress. Can you understand why he's refusing to?
Yes. I mean, I think that as a bureaucrat, you know, somebody who's been working in government for decades, you know, doesn't want to testify. I don't think there's anything else other than I don't want to be bothered testifying.
Yeah, well, isn't that just too bad?
To a political...
I'm sure he was paid handsomely for his work.
I mean,
too bad.
You know, yeah.
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 Okay.
It's exactly that. Too bad. Right. You know, you don't get to say that. You got to testify. I don't think there's anything else other than like he does not want to find himself at this, probably at the center of the story. He doesn't want to find himself in a political sort of a tug of war or fight.
Right.
And that's just tough shit.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
You have to testify if you're subpoenaed or and if you're not going to do it voluntarily, that's just tough.
Right.
And this is a problem actually right now, right? This is where we're seeing Congress to some degree trying to conduct oversight.
Yeah.
And now there has been a pattern, and this is not really unique to the Trump administration. Let's face it, you know, the Bush administration did this, not so much the Obama administration, but, you know, during the, you know, post invasion of Iraq, when Congress was investigating the WMD claims, you know, you had the Bush administration resisting, you know, oversight by Congress and not allowing certain individuals within the administration, within the executive branch, to testify. But we're seeing this pattern where it's like, I don't want to testify. I'm not going in. Why should I do it? But Congress is trying to conduct oversight. And for Mueller to actually say, this is all I'm going to say, you know, fine. If you want to read the report,
do it.
If you want to read parts of the report, that's
fine.
That actually would have an impact.
Yes, it would.
I believe that his own render, you know, his own reading of the report would be quite impactful.
Oh, absolutely, because people haven't, as you said, haven't read it, and the reason, what I mean, obviously, to get information is the reason for the hearings, but on a bigger level, it's to put them on television so the American public can see and hear what was in the report. It's why I believe they should open an impeachment inquiry, because if my information is correct, they'd have a much harder time. The Trump administration would. In telling people don't comply with the subpoenas. If it's an impeachment, they have no choice if that's correct, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there would still be, you know, look, they're gonna try to figure out ways in which that they can get out of doing that. And I think right now what we're seeing is the executive branch saying that Congress doesn't have any authority to even investigate this, to issue subpoenas, to conduct any sort of investigation that's criminal or of the president's behavior. They're literally making that argument. They're making that argument in court as these subpoenas are going through. So I think that this is just something that we're going to just see happening as, you know, as the months go by.
Right.
It doesn't help, obviously, that, you know, the guy that sort of investigated this and was silent for 2 years, suddenly he's saying, I don't want to do it either.
Right.
And the report speaks for itself. The report does speak for itself, but
it doesn't speak.
Congress also does have the right.
It doesn't speak. And it can't go on television to tell the American people what's in it. Yes, if you take the time and effort to read the thing, but we need show and tell because this is America.
Right. And I think that there are legitimate questions that, you know, that they have that should be raised. That Bob Mueller should respond to.
Of course.
But, you know, I wanted to get back to something else, as I mentioned about the report, which, you know, it's a 400-page report.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of, you know, to sit down and read that whole report. I don't expect people to read it in one sitting.
Right.
That's a lot of work.
Yep.
You're essentially saying, here's a book. I want you to read it. And
it's a thick book with tiny print and a lot of stuff in here. I'm thumbing through it right now. It's not an easy read, but it's important.
No, it's not an easy read. But what's amazing is that, you know, again, just to get down to, you know, sort of understanding what's there. And you asked me about, you know, did I learn anything new? What also came out that's quite lengthy is Michael Cohen's testimony transcripts from the House Intelligence Committee, you know, around a couple of weeks ago. That was about 650 pages. And the material in there is explosive, right? This is something that literally, what he had testified to behind closed doors was explosive, and it's just stunning that has not really attracted much attention.
Right.
That testimony transcript is a roadmap. It's certainly a roadmap for members of Congress. It's a roadmap for journalists on what to sort of chase as it relates to Trump, his business, and the questionable activities revolving around his business and his own behavior. So there's so much out there. And as I mentioned, that, you know, things are happening. News is breaking as we speak. particularly as it relates to this lengthy investigation. And it's also so partisan, right? I mean,
yes.
Everything is sort of politicized
yes.
at this
yep.
point, which is why we are playing the long game, right? And that long game may be in January or February or whenever it is that we get these underlying
right.
documents and we write this story and we explain to people, this is what happened, because it is, you know, what's being lost, in my opinion, is the historical value of this. This was an investigation into Russia's interference in the election, attempts to obstruct an investigation that was conducted by a special counsel by the President of the United States, and the roles that many people in his circle played
yep.
in that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the historical value of that, when we look back on it in years to come, I think is going to be huge. But it's so easy to sort of like kind of forget that it actually happened.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't plan on being alive 50 years from now, but I'd be fascinated
right, yeah.
to come back and see how history treats this episode and the whole Trump presidency.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
Jason Leopold,
yeah.
I got to run because we got such a busy show today, but I always appreciate your time and certainly your reporting. People can find you at BuzzFeedNews.com. Jason, at Jason Leopold on Twitter. And as always, thank you for your great work and for being here for us.
Appreciate it, Nicole, and thank you for the support as always.
Oh, my pleasure. Always, Jason Leopold. Again, find him at BuzzFeedNews.com for just amazing reporting. So this is the extended disco version of the show. We'll do this from time to time. Again, there's a lot going on in the world, and, you know, we need to cover it. So thank you for hanging, those of you who stuck with me on the live show. Of course, those of you who came over to the podcast for the extended version, welcome. We do this, you know, every day, Tuesday through Friday. I am Nicole Sandler. As always, thank you for listening. And we'll talk again tomorrow. Tomorrow's Thursday. So Howie Klein will be here. And yes, as always, a lot to discuss. Until then, thanks for listening and keep the faith, baby. Bye.